The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Anybody have any general questions while we're waiting for people to trickle in? Any questions about fall registration?
Is there a recommended number of IP classes you should take in the fall? Should you try to load up early so you have more options later? Should you stick to one or two?
So that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about today, so that's a good opening. We'll probably wait a few minutes for Mike to come in. That could be a good place to start. Do you want to start there?
Sure.
So the first question we had, which we were sort of looking for general questions while people were filtering in, happens to be a question that really covers a lot of the, a lot of the basic material of this advising session, which is how many IP classes should you look to take the first fall that you can choose classes, so your 2L fall. Do we want to start with questions, or do you want to do a little?
Well, how many, is everyone a 2L? Are there any 3Ls? I'm sorry, is everyone a rising 2L? Yeah.
Except for Alexis.
Who just loves IP events so much that she comes to all of them, which makes us very happy.
So this is Mike Carroll. Do all of you have him? Who's not an intro IP? Okay, most of you. Okay, perfect. That gives a good sense. So Mike Carroll, faculty director of the IP program. This is Meredith Jacob, assistant director. I'm the associate director, Sean Flynn.
Everybody gets to be a director.
And everybody gets to be a director. Why don't you start off?
I have a general spiel. About... So the way you should look at your law, one size doesn't fit all. Some people really do want to come to law school and specialize, and they're really sure, I just want to be a patent lawyer, and I'm really not interested in learning about con law, I just want to be a patent lawyer. And so if that's really who you are, then I would, double down on IP classes and really take a lot. But unless you're that sure, I would treat your law degree as a liberal arts degree in law. You need to get foundational access to the foundational concepts that apply in lots of different areas of practice. So even though it may be against my own interest because I want you in my classes, I think you need to focus on making sure that you've got business associations, evidence, administrative law. Those are the biggest areas of practice. And in an IP practice, you're certainly going to use evidence. You're certainly going to use administrative law. So it's not as if those are unrelated to IP, but those I just think are musts. So after you make a plan that at least covers those, then I think the approach to the IP classes is, again, the same thing. What are the broader IP classes that are going to apply across? So copyright, trademark, patent are the three big sort of broad classes. And copyright and patent are offered in the fall, and trademark is offered in the spring. I think if you want to really mark yourself out as an IP person, then you might want to take at least two of those three, because that then sort of lets you know. And then there's a whole series after that, I think, it's sort of what else you want to do. So I teach a class called Intellectual Property in Cyberspace, which is mostly copyright and trademark issues on the internet. Intellectual property licensing is another broad, lots of different licensing practices. We've got a number of international IP classes, so if you want international copyright, international patent, which are pretty specialized, but really will get you into understanding the international framework for, how IP law works in other countries, because IP law, like all other law, it's the IP law of the United States. And then we have trading agreements with a number of other countries where we basically have agreed to coordinate our IP laws. So the international and comparative will be understanding that international agreement and then what's the same and what's different in our countries, in other countries. I guess I would say that's where to focus your attention, but what else?
So we ran two career events in the last 3 weeks. We ran an advising session with attorneys from Finnegan and from Morrison Foster. And so Finnegan is an IP specialty law firm.
One
it's
of
a
the
very
largest.
Large one.
Yeah.
And Morrison Foster is general practice. And so we asked these attorneys, you know, what do you tell, like, if you could go back and tell law students, what should you take? You know, what would you do? And everyone from Finnegan said, take Civ Pro. Take as much Civ Pro as you can take while in law school.
If you're going to litigate.
Right,
yeah.
But that, they were a lot, it was a very litigation-heavy group of people. But they said, take Civ Pro, take advanced Civ Pro, learn how to do the lawyering thing. So, like, how do you write a motion? How does the whole process of motions practice work? And then the attorneys at Morrison Foster said, take whatever you like. Like, take things in law school that you like and you're going to do well at. So that's the advice that they gave.
Well, that's
you
true.
You know,
I mean,
we're going to give a little different advice, but that's the advice that was passed on by these two recruiting teams.
Yeah.
The hard answer, which is not a fun answer, is don't take things that fit into your schedule. I think it makes perfect sense to take classes with professors you like and that you think are interesting and good people to have, regardless of what they teach. I think that taking classes that are Thursday at 1 p.m., regardless of what they are, is probably not as quite as satisfying. You do want to get out and have a story, a little bit of what you learned. So I think that when people said take what you love, you know, if you come out and you say, yes, I want to do patent law, but I also took this string of environmental law classes while I was in law school because I really thought environmental law was fascinating, and even though I want to practice patent law when I get out, I wanted to learn about that. That's good, right? That you found something that's really interesting and you cared about it. What you don't want to do is have a collection of classes that you took just because they were the right times and didn't have exams. Like, that's what you want to avoid doing in that. And I think particularly what you want to avoid is graduating with a large collection of specialized but unrelated two-credit classes. That a big mistake is going through and just picking up a ton of like two-credit evening classes because they're easy to fit into your schedule without some idea of how to work your way through that with a narrative. I think that the big 3 and 4 credit classes like evidence and admin and antitrust and these big basic building blocks that Michael was talking about are a really important part of coming out and being able to do good work when you practice. Do you have a...
I'll add a couple things and open up some more questions. But so I think there are at least kind of two major tracks in the curriculum. There's kind of the patent track, and then there's what I would say is kind of the copyright communications media law track. So on the patent track, there's a pretty defined set of courses that are open and, you know, available to you for patents. So on, you know, patents, you have the prosecution side, so there's a class on patent prosecution. There's the basic patent law course. I would take that as early as you can, so that's offered next semester. You should take that first. That opens up the rest of them. Even where there are not prerequisites, you will get better grades and understand it better if you take patent law before you take prosecution international, etc. So there's kind of patent law, and then there's patent prosecution, then there's international patent, and there's patent litigation, and those are kind of the big cluster of patent law courses. And then there's some other things that we offer that give you kind of the dots on the I, if you will. There's, in the summer, there's a series of courses on pharma patent litigation, Hatch-Waxman, et cetera. So, you know, then you can start getting more detail. So if you're non-patent, then I think you have some different kind of courses to take. But you'll notice kind of if you do job searches, et cetera, there's very few firms that have a copyright practice. Like, they often have a patent practice or an IP practice that's really a patent practice. But then the copyright practice is usually called, like, media and communications or entertainment, et cetera, right? So there's a lot of copyright work there. But you don't just kind of take copyright prosecution, copyright litigation, et cetera. You need to have a different set of skills. And there I would think more towards who your clients are going to be if you're on that side of the equation. So if you're thinking more towards the kind of entertainment media clients, then you want to take entertainment law, you want to take copyright, of course, but you want to take communications law. You want to think about where the different kinds of work that those kind of clients are going to need, and they're not all going to be IP. So there I would say the core courses are copyright for sure, but also communications law, so that's basically the law of the FCC. So whether it's internet companies or media companies or et cetera, a lot of your work is going to be, you know, either on the IP side, but also on the communications law side, the FCC side, doing different kinds of filings and et cetera. Across the spectrum, I think one class that we haven't mentioned that I would put high on the list is something in antitrust. So either the core antitrust class or about every other year there's a more IP antitrust class offered. I don't think it's offered next year. I'm not sure. I haven't seen it on the curriculum yet. But whether you're on the copyright side or the patent side, antitrust is a key intersection because most of what these laws give you is some kind of exclusive right, some kind of monopoly power. And there's a large intersection between the antitrust laws and the IP laws that are important to do. And a lot of what FCC law is essentially antitrust at its core. It's a regulatory system that is there because of the market power of the organizations that are working within them. So those are kind of the two big sides. So trademark often falls in between. So if you're a patent guy, I think you want to take trademark because that's part of the industrial property piece. Also trade secrets, but it often fits also when people see themselves as soft IP, it's often kind of classified as copyright and trademark, so a lot of people do both of those sectors. So I think to some degree, everybody takes trademark, and then you have kind of your communications and media law track and your more industrial property track, is one way to see it.
And if I can jump on that, I mean, trademark is a very big area because every company has a brand. Right, and there's this International Association of Trademark Lawyers gets together once a year, and there's, you know, 6,000 lawyers at that thing, and you get in-house lawyers from all the big consumer products companies, plus all the attorneys who want to work for them, and, you know, every large company has multiple brands and multiple lines of business that all need trademarks. So we just had a couple of alums who were back over the weekend, and two of them just got a job. They're working at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office as trademark examining attorneys. Their job is to look at the applications for people who want to register marks and assess whether they're valid and stuff. So there's a lot, in terms of where's the work, is most of the work, I'd say that numerically most of the jobs are patent and trademark. But copyright, I just agree with Sean, you kind of build a copyright practice unless you're in LA or New York or a place where there's just media companies that are churning out copyrighted works all the time. So there's ways to build yourself into a copyright practice, but a lot harder to just walk in as an entry-level copyright lawyer.
Now let me answer your question. Like, how many should you take next? So you're a 1L and you're thinking, you know, this is the first time you get to decide how many credits you should take. So here I think you got to take the long view of looking at, and I would really think about which semesters you're going to do what. And a lot of people end up a few of their semesters, and it could be that you decide to do it next semester or whenever, decide to do things that suck up a lot of your time outside the classroom. And you want to be able to do those things. So those would be like internships, externships. So one of the great advantages you have of working in DC is you don't have to only work in the summers. You can work during the semester as well in places where you're essentially interviewing for jobs, even though they're not formally constructed like that. And I would say those opportunities, especially your 3L year, are very valuable. So you're going to be hired by someone who knows you, and you want as many opportunities to get to know people in the work environment and show off what you got as possible. So for that reason, I would actually argue for loading up your second. And the other thing is clinic. So clinic is like 14 credits. So if you decide to do the IP clinic, you find yourself in your third year with 14 IP credits. And if you haven't taken, you know, all these other courses that Michael just said, and it's on my mind because I've had a couple students come in and be like, whoa, I just got into IP clinic, and what do I do now? I haven't taken, you know, patent law or some of these other big areas. So I would load up on that stuff early so that you have the ability later to have the real choice of doing IP clinic, have the choice of doing internship, externship, possibly both semesters, year 3L a year, et cetera. So what are the ways to do that? So the, you know, one is to, is wherever, if you're planning in the fall of not doing one of those big things, I would take more credits. You know, if this is, if this, and you got to look at your activities as well. On the activity level, you know, my basic advice is don't do too many activities. You know, you're not going to get a job because you're in 18 different law clubs. You're going to get a job because you had awesome grades and because you worked for somebody. So don't overextend yourself on all the different clubs we have, right? So think about that. Do something because you're interested in it. Do stuff that's fun and keep yourself going. But try to really concentrate on, you know, what your professional development is over these four semesters you have left. And then really, there's two more, which is the two summers, and think about what you're doing in the summer. So one way is to load up in the semesters you're not doing other stuff. And the other way is the summer courses. So, you know, if you all haven't decided on the summer courses, look at those too, because that's a way to get some breadth and exposure into your curriculum, but also to bone up on some credits over the summer that you can then use later to take fewer. And in taking fewer, a lot of people go part-time, like especially their last semester 3L year. So if you're doing an externship or an internship that takes a lot of time and you've loaded up on those credits earlier, you can actually go part-time and you get a tuition reduction and you can make that work financially as well. So it's another thing just to think about, especially if you're doing the summer, because the summer courses require you to pay. So it only makes sense financially, tuition-wise, if you, you know, pay that summer and then go down later. Otherwise, you will end up paying more tuition overall. But so I would think, you know, that's, that would be my goal on not IP specifically, but courses in general, taking more when you have more time and taking probably fewer, especially in your third year. Yeah.
Well, can I just follow up one quick concrete answer on that? I would say if you think you want to do IP, you should very seriously consider taking either copyright, the IP licensing, or patent this first fall. But if you think you're going to do IP as one of your major specialties, all three of those are offered this fall. You should take one of those three, at least.
I have two questions.
Sure.
One is, if you don't have a science background, is it advisable to take patents, or should you start off taking something else? And my second question is, I noticed that international trademark is offered, and it doesn't say that trademark is offered next semester. So I was just curious, if you didn't list it as one of the key courses to start off with,
right,
if you wanted to take it, is that a little too much? If you haven't, you don't know what trademark is, and jumping into international trademark.
Yeah, I mean, on the second one, I would hesitate on doing international trademark. I'd wait and take trademark in the spring.
It will be offered in the spring. So it's not listed here because these are actually the classes that were taught in spring 2013, because we don't have technical confirmation of what's going to be taught in spring 2014, so we don't want to give out information we might have to change. But we have the very firm expectation that trademark will be taught in spring 2014. So if you don't take international comparative trademark this fall, you can take trademark in this spring. It will be offered.
Yeah, and the answer in the patent, so there are sort of three large areas of patent practice. There's patent prosecution, which means writing the patents and going to the patent office and getting. In order to do that kind of practice, you have to be a member of the patent bar. To become a member of the patent bar, you need a science degree. So that's the one area of practice where you do need the science degree. Patent litigation and patent licensing are often done by attorneys who aren't technical specialists. So should you take patent law? I guess my answer would be, if you think you have the kind of appetite to learn the facts in a patent case, then I would take it, because then you can make a credible case that, hey, I want to be a patent litigator. And it will help you sort of understand the issues. There's actually a lot of interesting purely legal issues that need litigating in patent cases. And there are a lot of general practice firms that basically gobbled up patent boutiques because they said, there's a lot of money in patent litigation and we can do it better than they can, because you have to convince a judge or a jury, right? So that would be the sort of, you know, you can't hurt yourself by taking patent, and you're certainly not excluded.
I would say, though, if you think you're going to take patent law as a non-technical background person, I would try to figure out a time in the next 2 years to also take the IP licensing and tech transactions.
Yeah.
So I think those would be that's a good pair if you're telling the story about why you're interested in patent, but have a sort of focus that's not patent prosecution.
I don't know if you had other students have this issue, but can you do the IP clinic if you work with a PTO?
We haven't had a problem with that. You mean from a conflict standpoint or from a scheduling standpoint?
From a conflict standpoint.
You can from a conflict standpoint because we don't currently, I think, have anything open in front of the PTO.
Well, did it get resolved? Because there are trademark applications that we're prosecuting.
That's a quote. So the clinic question, I can give you the contact information after.
Yeah, I mean, it is a working law firm, and so if the clinic has a client that's prosecuting business before the office, if you're working in the office, you've got a conflict of interest. So
it was on the list. I don't know if that the conflict list. Mm-hmm. On the page, it was on the list.
So I thought in the past I had knew someone who'd applied and gotten it cleared.
Well, maybe the client.
What year are you now?
Rising 3L.
Okay, so there's plenty of time to figure that out. You have 9 months until clinic applications are due, which will fly by, I admit. But if you come afterwards, I can give you the email of Professor Phillips, who's the head of the IP clinic, and she can talk to you about that.
In addition to the foundational subjects, as you're referring to them, are any of these prerequisites that we need to be considering for the two credit courses that come later?
Sure.
Yeah, we've held off on making any of them formal prerequisites, but no. I mean, I don't think that the sequencing is as critical, but focus on the basics.
There's a series, most of the ones that say advanced something or other say that you either have to have X course or permission of the instructor. So advanced copyright, it's most of the seminars, basically you're expected to take the core course before the seminars. So advanced copyright, you're supposed to take copyright first, but you can have permission of the instructor. International patent, I think, is like that as well. I think most of the international ones are like that, international trademark, international copyright, international patent. Etc. For people, there's a lot of people who weren't in the intro course. The other one to consider, if you haven't already, for an intro course is the two intro to international IP law courses in the summer operate as a functional equivalent. It's much shorter than the actual intro course, but it does have kind of a survey overview of the basic topics in IP law, taught through the treaties, but the concepts track well onto U.S. law. So that's another one to consider.
One other thing to think about is, as you're strategizing, and I know you've just done arguments on your appellate briefs and you worked hard on those, so you've got your writing sample, but you actually want to plan on having a different writing sample when you're applying for jobs, because everybody's got their 1L appellate brief. You want to do something that's going to distinguish you better. It's going to be more interesting to talk about in a job interview. So one idea would be, at some point you have to do an upper level writing requirement. Often people think of that as a 3L, and it makes a lot of sense to wait till you're 3L, but the one hesitation I have about waiting is if you're interested in applying for judicial clerkships, a writing sample's usually required, and that would be one. And also some employers, want a writing sample. It's not as common, but sometimes. So think about what that writing sample is going to be about and how you're going to get it done. One thing, for non-judicial clerkships, a lot of employers want shorter writing samples. So the upper level, even if you do an upper level writing requirement, they don't want to read your whole paper. They want to read a digested version of it. Judicial clerkships may be a little bit of the same thing, but just plan on having a good writing sample, and the federal clerkships, the applications are like Labor Day. So that means you need to have created your writing sample during your 2L year. The advantage also is if you do a seminar, that professor knows your writing and can write a better recommendation. But other ways to do it are to work for the IP brief, to write for the IP brief. There are other writing opportunities, but plan on exploiting writing opportunities to create that second writing sample.
Alexis, do you want to talk about the IP brief process really briefly?
Sure. So we have cycles throughout the year, so it's not just once a year where you can apply to be on the IP brief. There are several different positions, so you can be an editor or you can be a blogger. And then eventually, for next year, you can apply for an e-board position. But what you do is, if you're a blogger, you're going to be writing monthly stories, blog short stories of any IP issue that you want to write about, and we'll publish them on the ipbrief.net site. So it's a good way to get like your name in the search engine. Like when people look you up, they can see like your writing samples, a short version of what you can do. And if you're an editor, we'll have you doing essentially what a journal will be doing. So you'd be spading for our actual physical publication, the IP brief. And that's what it's about. So you can look on ipbrief.net. There are applications on there, and we generally like post when we're looking. And we'll send out announcements if you're on the listserv, the IPLS listserv or the IP brief listserv. So if you look out for those, you can be a part of the IP brief and have some writing samples.
And it's a great way to put concrete interests on your resume. So when you list publications on your resume, you list the titles of those, right? So if you sit down and you take a class that you're really interested in and you do spend your time and you write four blog posts that go to the IP brief, you get four lines on your resume where you get to write those sentences of what the titles of those four posts were, right? And that's a really concrete way when someone looks at your resume. Everybody writes in their cover letter that they care about IP and they have never ever wanted to do anything more than work at this place. And it's a little bit transparent. And so having this where you've written these articles and they are concrete things that you can list on your resume that you have actually written something about very much goes in this sort of show and not tell school of demonstrating interest. And so, for example, when you're talking about getting into patent law, if you don't have a technical background, one important thing to do might be join the IP brief and, you know, write three or four short blog posts that you have on your resume that really says, okay, this is an area I know something about, it's an area that I really care about.
I'd probably even go a step further on that. I mean, if you, one of the best ways to make yourself competitive in the fall hiring process is to write something now that's not your your brief, you know. So I would think about that as a summer project, and then I would write at least one thing your 2L year for sure. But those, you see the resumes come forward, they all look about the same, but that little, if you can have a publications line with something in there, it makes you stand out a lot more. So I would think, you know, if you want to make yourself as competitive as process in the fall process, make sure you have something that's not a rhetoric brief as a writing sample by the time the applications start, which is August. You know, put it on your summer agenda to write something. And it can be a blog. A blog is a great thing to write, and they're pretty easy, and you can do something that you're interested in. And it's published, and you can submit something to the IP brief. But if you don't have that, you know, find something else. And when you're at your jobs or whatever you're doing this summer, really try to make sure that you're finding something, writing something that you can share. And if you're not going to get that because all your work is client protected, et cetera, think about what else you're going to do. But the people who kind of come into a job environment with that rhetoric brief, it hurts you.
One option on that front is the summer classes are all really short classes, but they're pretty focused. So if you think you want to try to write something short this summer and you don't have a topic to start with, you could pick a class that's in an area you're interested in, either see if the class presents something or talk to the professors about what a short, and don't sit down and try to write a law review comment this summer. Trying to sit down, I think, with no sort of guidance structure and writing like a full law review comment this summer would be very hard. But if you sit down and you try, Alexis snuck away right when I'm going to make this promise, so it may not be true. But I think that if you get in touch with Alexis and you write a good 2 or 3 page blog post, even if you're not on the IP brief, if you send it to them and it's like well edited, you can get it published there.
Yep. It takes submissions.
And I will make the foolhardy volunteer commitment right now that if you do that and you want to get in touch with me after the summer session for editing help and getting it in shape for that, Pidget will help you do that as well. So you probably all have my email addresses that I emailed you today, but if you don't, come up afterwards and I'll give you that as well.
Yeah, things that make good, you know, transitions to writing is if you had a more open-ended exam, if you're taking one of the summer courses, your exam there, I mean, you take something that kind of may have started as not a public writing process and transform it into a public writing process. Same with your work over the summer. I mean, if you write a client memo, if you can extract the client information and use that legal research and publish it in a different form, but, you know, take something you really spent a lot of time working on. I'm not necessarily saying, you know, take a whole new, you can, but it's hard to take a part of your summer and write something completely new. I'd write it something that you're either related to a, you know, a class that you loved, a class you're taking, or a work or a project you're doing on at work, but try to meld something into something you can share that will be interesting to the kind of employers you want to go to. So if you're looking for IP employers, you know, have something in IP, and you're, the people reading that will be much more interested in writing it. In reading it.
I have a couple other things, but do you have more questions? What's, what are you guys thinking about? No? All right, no spiel. So one other thing, this is my personal view, but it's a very strongly held view, which is that I think one of the best first jobs out of law school is to work for a judge. And I don't care what level of the hierarchy it is. And my argument for why that is because judges are professional decision makers. They have people, they're professional skeptics. People from both sides are constantly pitching them arguments about why they should make a decision in their favor. And they are experienced, seasoned decision makers who've seen a whole variety of attorneys try a whole variety of kinds of arguments. And they have their own sorting mechanism for how they decide what's a good argument and what's not. And getting to work for one of these seasoned decision makers gives you immediate access to that decision-making process. And you start to learn what's effective advocacy and what's not. How do I sort issues to figure out what's important and what's not? How do the unwritten issues make their way into a case? And how do the unwritten aspects of the decision-making process actually influence? That's the sort of sophisticated piece. Plus, you learn how a courthouse works, even if you don't think you want to litigate. I think it's still useful because the judgment, you know, practical wisdom, judgment is what you're ultimately aiming at to be a good lawyer. And these are people who are in the practice of making judgments all the time. So you, in addition, judges often want to make sure you succeed. So you become part of another alumni network. In addition to your law school alumni network, you're the judge's alum. And the judges take more or less interest in their alums, but there are definitely judges who will take you on as a mentee and will make sure that they connect you up with somebody. And even if they don't, those judges are known by many attorneys, and so you will de facto have access, you know, an entree, something to talk about. So, and in DC, in addition to sort of the standard federal courts and the superior court, and in Montgomery County and in Alexandria and Arlington, other courts that you might not be aware of that do some IP, the Court of Federal Claims is the place where all the claims against the U.S. government are brought, including claims that the U.S. government infringed a copyright, infringed a patent, infringed a trademark. There is the International Trade Commission, which is hearing patent cases all the time, where patent owners are trying to block in what they say are infringing imports at the border. So, where, you know, lots of sort of judicial opportunities, but do consider that. That's my argument for why that ought to be job number one that you aim for.
Questions? Other job number ones are like other government offices that are involved in the area. Anybody you would potentially advocate before as an attorney are great places to work within. So, you know, if your job is to go to the PTO, then being on the inside of the PTO and knowing how that process works helps you become an advocate before that body. So kind of looking at the big mesh, and this is for, you know, first you can talk about first job, or you can describe this as great internships or whatever. I mean, the other thing of job advising, I often give people is, you know, think about the kind of three different sectors, judicial, executive, and then private sector, and then potentially nonprofit,
and then look at, try to get one experience in each of those, ideally before you graduate or before you kind of hit your first job. You can include the first job as one of those, but try to do, you know, something in the executive branch around the issues you're doing, whether it's in the FCC or whether it's in the PTO or the Copyright Office, et cetera. Something in some kind of a judicial body, which could be an administrative law judge or an actual Article III judge. The ITC is another one. Did you mention the ITC and the patent and trademark field? They do trade injunctions to keep goods from coming in, but it's basically, it's full-scale litigation on a concentrated docket, so it's a great place to get litigation experience, whether you're as a clerk or an attorney, but you do a lot of trials really quick, so in a year, you know, people get 3-4 trials. So, you know, something as a decision maker, you know, so thinking about judge as the decision maker and executive agency, and then, you know, the private sector, most people focus on the private sector as the law firms and the advocates, but yeah, definitely thinking about the other branches.
So I have a short-term question. Are people still looking for summer jobs? Are people still, are they set? Are you still looking? Roughly, who's still looking? So on the still looking front, I think I was at this point in my first year when I didn't know what I was doing for the summer. There's two things to think about, two sort of paths through that, maybe 2.5. One is that a lot of small firms that do not have summer hiring programs will still take interns. So we did a small firm hiring panel, and all of them said, we don't have summer hiring, we don't do like a summer class, we don't advertise, but if you got in touch with us and had a good story about how what we did was the type of law you wanted to practice, and you were willing to come in and commit to working a certain number of hours a week, yeah, sure, we'd take you on as a summer, you know, a summer intern. It's not an official externship because you can't do externships for for-profit companies. You can't do an externship and get credit if you're working for a for-profit law firm. So some of them might be volunteer, some of them would be paid, but if you're, I mean, I think that getting the experience is worth doing it volunteer, and you can pair that if you want with doing the summer classes that we offer. The IP ones run at the very beginning of the summer, so they're all over by the 21st of June. So you come in, do 2 weeks of classes to pick up some credits and become eligible for financial aid, and then do a summer internship at a law firm, and that's a way to both get a leg up on some of the IP experience and then also get experience at a law firm. And a lot of these places said, yeah, we don't necessarily do the summer class, but if we get someone and they're good, we do hire paid law clerks. So you could do a summer, get an experience, get a writing sample, and then if you do good work and you fit with the firm, work as a paid law clerk after. That's one way to think about what's left. The other answer, and I think this is sort of, again, it's piecing together a couple things, but you can do classes and a dean's fellowship. So I think there are still a number of professors and programs in the IP clinic who are all offering dean's fellowships. And so what those don't do is they don't get you new outside contacts. But what they can do is you can pair them with classes and get a really good writing sample and sort of focus on getting a really aggressive jump on the fall recruiting and getting a sort of an aggressive fall internship, right? If you don't do anything in the summer outside of the law school, you should really think about what next year you're going to do outside of the law school, but you can look at that one too. So those are the ways to sort of fill in your summer if you're still looking for something now.
PGIP will have 2 slots, and we'll announce them very late because we hope that you will go out and get summer jobs first, but we will have a couple of research positions geared towards that. But if you're, for those of you who raised your hand, feel free to come in and talk to us, especially in the next week or two, and let us, you know, tell us what you're doing and see if there's anything we can do to help point you along the path. There's actually, I mean, it's, you're living a law school calendar, so it feels like it's the end of the year, which it is in our year, but a lot of places are just now starting to hire interns, so you're actually not out of the game. April in DC is when a lot of organizations just start their hiring. So I know somebody who just got, you know, a job at NPR 2 days ago. You know, I mean, there's still really good positions still out there, even paid ones. This wasn't, it was a paid position, but a lot of them take interns kind of whether they're university or law school or whatever on the same kind of calendar. And April is actually when they do a lot of their hiring. So don't feel like all the positions are gone. They are not. Keep looking. But do come and talk to us when we know some of the places perhaps.
Any other general questions?
If in the fall, with the recruitment stuff, you end up applying just like general practice, medium or large firms, will they ever, that don't specifically do IP, do you think they would ever be like, we're not an IP firm, like this concentration of IP classes isn't helpful for us, or do they, would that be fun?
It doesn't.
Like, is it limiting in what you can do? Like,
well, I guess, I mean, I've never heard that. I think it would be, I think the question is, do you have a coherent story to tell about why you took those classes and what, whether those interests match the kind of work they have available? But no, I don't see that as sort of being a limiting thing. I mean, you know, if you interview with a firm that's primary practice is reinsurance law, this is the practice, there's a firm that specializes in that in DC, and that's the, you basically, the insurance company sells one policy, and then the insurance company goes out and gets insurance for itself in case it might have to pay. And, you know, who takes classes other than contract law and maybe insurance law that prepares them for that practice? So they're not, you know.
Yeah, and I think the people who we actually, we were telling you the story in the beginning of the two advising sessions, the firm where they said, I want to see that you're interested in something, was the general practice firm. So I think that when you're recruiting at a general practice firm, you know that the reality is when you're picking classes in law school, you just have to pick something. And it's really impossible that you would pick the exact path through law school that in retrospect you wanted for your job. For most people, for most general practice work, that like, you know, the reinsurance practice, or you know, you're gonna do, someone came and spoke about working, doing lottery work. Right? These are really, there aren't classes for this in law school. So what you need to do are take classes where you learn to read and write like a lawyer. And if you think you want to go to a big general practice firm, you should probably take BA. You know, like there are some basic threshold. it's a good class to take. But there are basic threshold classes you should take. But the idea that you'd specialized in something being a deficit, I think just, I mean, it's possible if you wanted to go into a very specialized area and you hadn't taken any classes in that other thing, that would be a deficit. But if you want to do something general and it appears that you have a different interest, I don't think that really, I actually think that's a benefit, and you can tell a story about, yeah, this is something I'm interested in, but I'd like to get a good start in the general practice firm.
The only other thing is there is, I cannot imagine a general practice firm that has never had an IP issue come across its desk. I mean, that's
not mid and large size.
Yeah, that's the other thing is there are people who want to practice in this field, but you're also going to encounter legal issues, whatever, you know. Your company have a website, you might have copyright issues.
Yeah.
You got a brand name, you got trademark issues, right?
And on the media and entertainment side, I mean, a lot of what you're doing is contracting, licensing, employment stuff as well. I mean, you know, that's why I think that there's, the patent people to some degree can just do patents all day long and probably get a job. But the copyright practice is really a media, I mean, it depends where you want to hit, but I would encourage you to hit, you know, again, the kind of, there's the communications side, there's the employment side. I mean, a lot of those copyright deals are really inside of employment contracts, so I would take employment law, you know, I mean, so you end up looking like fairly a bit of a generalist, and you're going to have, you know, 3 to 5 concentrated IP courses, but then you're going to have a lot of stuff that plays into that.
Yeah, I just sort of had a question. I mean, I think, you know, my situation is a little different. I'm a patent agent already, so I've got a little different track here, but sort of on behalf of the other students, I just wonder, you know, I'm hearing about the government jobs and the law firm jobs. I know that a lot of, you know, the private corporations have in-house legal departments, and some of them have big IP needs. And I'm sort of not hearing the suggestion that they contact the private corporations. I'm just wondering, you might know something I don't. Do private corporations not look for law students the way law firms would? Or on the other hand, would private corporations with IP departments be an option that they should be looking into? I'm sort of asking.
I think, yeah, so for internships, the companies are available to go to. As your first job out of law school, almost impossible. The in-house counsel jobs, they don't want to pay to train you, is the basic idea. Now, that might be changing. I think some companies are bringing more of the work in-house, and some of the patent prosecution is coming in-house, so that patent prosecution may be an exception. I do know of students who've done in-house work. So Discovery Communications is just in Silver Spring. I know people have gone up there and worked and gotten copyright work.
Maybe AOL in Vienna? Maybe.
And AOL, right. There's a bunch of technology companies in Northern Virginia, and that's true for internships. That is a place to look.
So that might be helpful for some of
yeah.
those guys.
Yeah.
I would absolutely keep that on. I know Alexis is working for, I'm pointing at her chair, is working for a pharmaceutical company in their copyright and trademark practice.
And there's tons of them up the I-270 corridor, right?
Yeah. But I have heard some of what Michael was saying. I mean, I was talking with one woman, this again from pharmaceuticals, from Teva the other day, who was saying they're bringing a lot of their outside contracting in, and they're starting to hire young lawyers directly into the firm because they're way cheaper than paying what an associate would charge to do that work if they just do it in-house. So I'm hearing some of that. And the other thing, of course, is there's no better place to kind of move into a law firm than being working for the client. Like, if you've got a good relationship with the general counsel of a firm, even if they're not going to hire a young attorney, that recommendation is the best recommendation you can
That's
get. It's like they really like us, and you could then go to the firm that takes on that business, you know, if you're looking to segue into the firm, et cetera. But yeah, so I definitely keep businesses on as a great place to get experience, whether it's post-grad or as an internship, for sure.
Well, and the corollary to that in D.C. is trade associations. So a lot of trade associations have offices in D.C., and they are, again, not normally on the normal legal cycle for hiring. So the trade associations are not people who finished all their summer hiring in, you know, mid-February. They're not, I think, like the companies, like the general counsel offices, they're not a perfect target for jobs directly out of law school, but they're a really good way to sort of get a feel for the field, to become a known quantity. They're a good box to check for an internship while you're in law school, but they're probably not the best goal for employment after. Some people
We've
do. They're
seen
just
people
that
go to the association straight out of school as well. Some of our favorite people. Okay.
Can I toss in
yeah.
one more suggestion here?
Yeah, please.
I don't know how many of the, you know.
How many people are like patent specific? Okay. Good.
So, I don't know how many of the, I hate to say younger students, it sounds condescending, but a little younger, are just thinking in terms of like going through the job offerings that are posted by WCL. But it seems to me one option is that for them to look for attorney jobs that are being advertised in the general job media for, for intellectual property or contracts or whatever. Because those companies or those law firms, even though they're advertising for attorneys, if they're looking to hire attorneys,
yeah.
possibly they're also looking additionally for law student help. So it's worth checking the newspaper and web ads to see who's looking for help, period, I would think.
Yeah, no, that's a good suggestion. Legal Times is a place where the area firms advertise. And now I guess they got bought up, so it ends up going into some national database, right, when you then drop down your location.
And definitely, I don't know if it goes without saying, but apply for jobs that are not advertised. I mean, if you want to work for, especially at the companies and stuff, they don't advertise summer positions. You just write them, and because you really want to work in that spot. So do a little bit of research to figure out if they have a general counsel's office or what it might look like, and then you write to the person you'd like to work for, and say, "My summer's available. Can I work for you?" And almost everybody take a summer position when it's offered, if they fit well. So definitely apply for jobs that don't exist.
So one other thing, you're not going to want to hear this, but it's just it's a little bit. So I agree with Sean in terms of the advantages of loading up on credit, but just put you on notice that your first semester of your second year is the hardest semester of law school. And the reason it is because you still have to read for class. You still have to do everything you've learned to do this year. But now you got to do plus, right? So maybe you're part of a student organization. Maybe you're looking for a job. Maybe you're working a little bit. So it's two different kinds of demands on your time. Right now it's just your class schedule. And as demanding as that is, it's not that hard a management task to keep yourself on task, but now suddenly you're making appointments. I've got meetings, I got to meet with this student organization, I got to meet with this employer, I got to go downtown and do this, and I got to read for class. And learning how to manage your time is the challenge. So, but the nice thing is then it's over and everything gets easier, because now you're a professional juggler. Like, this is your first time. So if time management has been a challenge up till now, I would say focus on how am I going to tackle the time management issues to make sure I'm managing it efficiently. If you've already got that down, no problem. It's, you know, you're going to like it because you chose the classes. Nobody else chose them for you except for GrimPro. But it is, just be aware of this challenge of this new way of having to deal with two types of obligations, because it's easy to let your classwork slide as you start to make commitments to do things that have very concrete schedules, and that's not what you want to let happen, because remember that your classwork is still the number one reason you're here, and these other things are supplementary to that.
Cool. Well, we've kept you for already all the time we said we were going to, so we'll stick around if you have any one-on-one questions, for sure. But thank you for coming, and if you didn't get the email from me earlier today, it means you're not on the IPLS list, so please come sign up here and we'll add you. That's it.